Live from the biggest small town in America.
This is WGN Chicago, radio home of millions throughout mid-America.
Radio? Well, radio became the Pied Piper to a strange new world.
Time to climb up on our big shoulders and get inside our massive heart.
This is the Saturday Night Special with Amy Guth.
720 WGN. Hey, it's Amy Guth, and this is the Saturday Night Special. You heard the woman. Thanks for tuning in tonight. I hope you're enjoying the sort of vaguely springtime-ish weather that we're having this evening. We're getting there, my friends. We're getting there. Do not forget to set those clocks tonight. We're already at the spring forward, fall back situation. And another thing, if I may just take a moment of your time, I know everyone is celebrating the St. Patrick's Day stuff because all day here on the at the Michigan Avenue Showcase Studio here at Tribune Tower, I have been seeing so many people decked out in various degrees of sobriety, but decked out in green and sparkles and all that good stuff. And here is my only request is please do not get behind the wheel of a car. Everyone, please make a point to take a cab, take an Uber, take a Lyft, call a friend, crash on their couch, do whatever, but don't. Please do not drive if you have been drinking. It is.
You do know that this holiday is one of the holidays that those of us who used to drink call amateur days?
There's
a reason.
Well, it is one of the drinking holidays, and it is also, there's a direct correlation with these so-called drinking holidays and a spike in alcohol-related automotive fatalities. So, guys, please, let's do the right thing. Let's protect each other. Let's save families lots of grief and get home safely and help others do the same. There. That is my PSA. It is an important one. Everybody do the right thing. And if you're, you know what? Here, I'm not done. If you're worried about having an awkward conversation, you know what? A little bit of awkwardness is worth it to save lives. Because a lot of times people say, well, I didn't want to say anything because I didn't want so-and-so to be mad at me. I didn't want to confront them about not driving. Do it anyway. Literally can save lives with that conversation. Okay, now I'm done. So tonight, here on the Saturday Night Special, as you know, this is the show where we let topics breathe a little bit and we talk about them at length and we kind of unpack them a little bit more than we can during the week. And so tonight we are going to be talking all about voter behavior. Apathy, empowerment, all of that good stuff. Because obviously election season is upon us and there's a lot to talk about. What I don't necessarily want to talk about is candidates in particular, because we all see what they're doing. We see the candidates. We see what's going on out there. What I'm more interested in is the voters and the supporters around different candidates. So that's really what we're going to be talking about tonight. We've got an esteemed panel of experts that are going to be in studio and on the phone with us tonight, and we're going to be talking all about it. We're going to start with kind of the history a little bit of voter engagement and when did we see big voter engagement, and we'll be talking about things that are driving factors with voter engagement. Some of that is technology. Some of that is outrage. I think maybe we have seen an example of that in just recently here in this city, perhaps. Certainly, we have seen examples where we can say, you know, maybe there's not a problem with voter apathy. Maybe we're seeing very, very engaged people, perhaps people that are a little too passionate about the candidates that they're supporting. All of those things, all things we're going to be talking about tonight. So please stick around. As ever, we're taking thoughtful conversation on the topic. So we're open to comments at 312-981-7200. And of course, I'm on social media at Amy Guth, G-U-T-H, Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, all those places. So feel free to start these conversations because I'll be looking at those during the show and all week long. So feel free to find me there if you're a little shy about calling in or texting. All right, my friends, let's take a little break. And when we come back, we will have our panel convened and we will talk all about voter behavior here on 720 WGN.
Dr. King, Malcolm X, freedom of speech is as good as sex. Abe, Lincoln, Jefferson, Tom, they didn't need the atomic bomb. We need beauty, we need art, we need to get in rhythm. Don't give up your freedom of speech. Power to the people is in our reach.
Don't just sit there, let's get to it. Speak your mind, there's nothing to it. Vote!
And if you don't vote, you're gonna get a spanking. Cut.
720 WGN. That was, of course, Madonna's Rock the Vote. effort, let's say, commercial spot that she did back in the day. We all remember Rock the Vote. It was this campaign that was all about getting the young and cool people very engaged as voters. And you know what? I think it did a pretty good job, only I think a lot of people have forgotten about it. So we talk a lot about voter apathy. We talk about voter engagement, all those good things. And that is the big topic tonight here on the Saturday Night Special. I'm Amy Guth, and I have convened a most excellent panel of folks tonight here talking all about all of this great stuff. So joining us, we have David Ferris, who is chair of political science and public administration at Roosevelt University. We have Will Caskey, who does lots of things, and I'm going to let him explain exactly what it is because it sounds very interesting and yet quite complicated. And Derek Bagley, who is with, also does a lot of cool things, but who is with Chicago Votes, an organization that really helps young voters, particularly first-time voters, navigate all the stuff that is involved with being a first-time voter. Because you know what? If you go to the polls and you're not liking it, or if you're trying to register to vote and it's frustrating, you're just not going to do it. And on the phone, we have our good friend Rebecca Sive, who is a lecturer and program director of the Women in Public Leadership Program at the Harris School of Public Policy at the University of Chicago, and author of Every Day is Election Day, A Woman's Guide. Everyone, welcome, my esteemed, wonderful panel. I'm going to turn on all your microphones so everybody can say hello.
Hello, this is Derek Bagley.
There we go. I was like, not all at once. All right, my friends. So here's where I would like to start. I'd like to start out by talking a bit about kind of the history of voter engagement, because I think it'll provide a little bit of context for what we're talking about. We think of voter engagement as just kind of being a thing we throw around. We hear a lot of talking heads, a lot of pundits say that on all the Sunday talk shows and that kind of thing. And we hear a lot of hypothesizing about voter apathy, voter engagement. As much as we have been very concerned about voter apathy in recent elections, I think recent events, especially in our own city, certainly are painting a very different picture. That in fact, perhaps people are a little too engaged, perhaps a little too empowered, because we've seen some things perhaps boil over, which we'll talk about in a bit. But let's kind of rewind a little bit, and as we think about historic examples where we saw high voter engagement or particularly low voter engagement, what stands out in your minds?
Well, I think if you're looking at primaries, this is David, by the way. So if you're looking at primaries, one of the most important things when you're looking at turnout is whether the contest is considered to be serious or not. So one of the most important predictors of whether people are going to turn out in a primary is whether the voters consider that contest to be, you know, decided or not decided, right? So in 2004, for example,
meaning
for the Democrats,
do they feel like their vote counts?
Do they feel like their vote counts, or do they feel like there's a predetermined favorite and mm-hmm. there's nothing they can do about it? So in 2004, Democratic turnout was terrible, even though there was the very high voter engagement based on sort of the things that the Bush administration was doing. But Kerry wrapped up that nomination so early that the turnout numbers are dreadful, right? Mm-hmm. And if you look at, say, the Republican side this year, the turnout numbers are very high because the contest is so tight. And on the Democratic side, I think the assumption heading in was that Clinton had this wrapped up, and that I think has driven Democratic turnout down a little bit. So that's one big thing to keep in mind, is the voters' perception of whether you're going to have a very vigorous race or whether there's a sort of a predetermined, you know, favorite heading into that contest.
Certainly. Rebecca, you started to say?
Yeah, I wanted to add to that the fact, you know, looking back, that it's been since, I think, 1964 that women voters have exceeded male voters in presidential elections. And, you know, they were women voters really were responsible, so to speak, for the two elections of President Obama. So you might draw from that women voters have taken this responsibility seriously and have acted on it. And so I think that when they have the chance to turn out for a candidate who has an agenda they favor, they absolutely do.
And why would you say that is? Why do we see such a high voter turnout from women?
Well, I don't know so much about 64, but if you look in these more current elections, so-called women's issues have been primary topics of discussion in these presidential campaigns, and that's certainly true this year as well. So, you know, there's a direct stake there on those issues for any adult woman who's thinking about who she wants to vote for. I think the second thing that's important is that on the broader range of women's issues that may not all affect any individual woman, women understand that, you know, it's the combination of job opportunity and childcare and access to healthcare and all of that that is so critical to their opportunity to compete equally. And therefore, who is president really, really matters.
Certainly. You know, you mentioned 64. What's interesting to note about the 1960 and 1964 elections is we saw much higher voter turnout right then. The year before, so or election before, 1956, we saw 59.3% voter turnout. 1960, it bumped up to 62.8. 64, a little bit lower, 61.4, but then back down to 60% in 1968. So we did see kind of a bump right then around that time for sure. And then it dropped off significantly down in the mid-50s, 72 and 76, kind of going all the way down to 50% in 88. It was like this steady, steady decline for sure. Will, you have a comment about this.
Yeah, that's a really good place to jump off here, that spike in the early 60s and then the decline, because something that we don't usually think about in terms of who can vote and who does is that, for example, the Voting Rights Act in the 60s suddenly really boosted the number of people who actually could vote, and so you have this spike. But then you'll see this throughout the past 100 years, that there'll be this big formative event like World War I, Great Depression, World War II, women's suffrage, the Civil Rights Act, where more people get access to it, and then you have the sudden surge of people voting, but then it'll start to drop off. Because suddenly the issue's not as important anymore. You know, when you can't vote, and all of a sudden you can, then that's a big deal. You want to go out and vote. You vote as many times as you can. The next person who's a couple years younger, maybe they don't have as much of a reason to vote, and it kind of tapers off. And I think Derek might have some more thoughts on that.
Yeah, no, I do actually. This is Derek Bagley from Chicago Votes. Something that I think is important to know is that when we're measuring voter turnout, we're measuring the amount of people who are already registered to vote who are actually going out and doing it. So when you see a number like, you know, 75% turnout, that's only of registered voters. And currently, only one-third of the population are registered to vote. Oh, no, I think it's backwards. One-third are not registered. Now, this is an issue. So as more people get access to the ballot, that would, in theory, you would think that people would be chomping at the bit to go and register. However, registration is difficult. It's hard to know where you're registered, when you last registered, if you are at all. And so if there's this roadblock to creating habitual voting, people are actually more apt to stay home in the general, you know, eligible voter population as opposed to those that are, you know, already, you know, on board. And I think that you watch that over time, you know, especially among younger generations that have not been properly schooled in civics and why this is a duty that we have to, you know, take seriously, are just not registered flat out, even though they can vote, period.
You know, one of the things in terms of Chicago politics, if you look back on voter turnout in, for instance, 1983, when Harold Washington was elected, there was an enormous turnout in the African-American community. That's why he won. And, you know, it was clear that people felt they had something at stake. And, of course, the same thing was true with Barack Obama. So, you know, I think it's absolutely right that sometimes people just sort of sit back and say it doesn't matter or what's the difference. But it is also clear that when a candidate can make the case that I am history-making and I will do for you, you know, in a way that others have not, then voters do register and do turn out.
Well, that's another good issue. And then going back to David's point, thinking that something won't make a difference isn't necessarily always negative. I mean, I'm an opposition researcher, so take this with a grain of salt. I'm talking my book here. But to me, an election is about making a choice. You choose candidate A, candidate B, yes, no on a ballot question, or yes, no, this judge should keep his job. And the fact is that if you don't see a distinction between one choice and another, you have much less of an incentive to vote. And that doesn't necessarily mean it is bad. I mean, sometimes it just means that you're happy, you don't care, you're doing fine, you don't think anything needs to be changed, and you don't see how something will change. Okay, well, that's not necessarily like the traditional definition of apathy, like dropping out, but it still, I mean, it still does mean that you're going to not vote. Or on the other hand, you might just feel depressed about the whole thing. You think that just, well, okay, well, not anything, no matter what, it's all useless, it's all hopeless.
both are different versions of just not seeing a distinction. And when people start to see a distinction, whether from candidates themselves or just from events, that's right. when it starts to, people start to pay more attention.
Well, go ahead.
And I think it's important that we even define voter apathy as we're seeing it. I mean, I kind of see it on a spectrum, really, because I think it's bigger than just not voting. I think sometimes there's a degree of taking it seriously. I mean, I've heard anecdotally, but I've heard people just say things like, I don't know, you get in there and there's just all these boxes to check and I can't remember anything. You just check whatever you remember. I couldn't remember who stood for what. I think there's that. I would put that on one end of that spectrum of voter apathy for sure. My friends, tonight we are talking all about voter behavior, not really the candidates, not really the issues, all about voter behavior. And we have an esteemed panel of experts here, David Ferris, Will Caskey, Derek Bagley, and Rebecca Sive, all here with us for the next hour and a half or so. We're here with you till 9 o'clock talking about all this stuff, taking your very thoughtful, calm, and partisan comments. 312-981-7200. You can call or text that number. Or, of course, you can find us all on social media, and we can keep this conversation going there. We're going to take a little break, and we come back. More of this all about voter behavior here on 720 WGN.
We will stand our ground.
We will be brave.
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 We will be heard.
Heard.
We will.
We will.
We will.
We will organize.
We will
vote because we matter.
Because you matter.
We will vote
because we make a difference.
We will vote.
We will.
We will.
720 WGN. It's the Saturday Night Special. I'm Amy Guth. You are listening to a wonderful little clip that esteemed producer Rachel Woodall put together. We're pulling all these wonderful clips of voter encouragement throughout the ages, and that was one of them indeed. So because we're doing that, because tonight we're talking all about voter behavior. We're not really talking about the issues. We're not really talking about the candidates. We're talking about the people driving all of it. We're talking about us, the voters. So we are unpacking that issue, but we're starting out with the historical part of it. And I'm joined by a very esteemed panel of experts this evening. On the phone is Rebecca Sive. We also have David Ferris in studio, Will Caskey in studio, and Derek Bagley in studio. I'm going to turn everybody's microphone so we can all participate in this conversation. But, you know, before the break, we were kind of talking about why and what drives high or low voter turnout. And what I feel like I really mostly heard was actually something that wasn't about data as much as it was about human emotions. It seems like when there's an event that moves people very deeply, that's when we see these high voter turnout numbers throughout history. We've seen that from the beginning, when either positive or negative, people react to something, to a very universal or very human thing, and that's what gets people to the polls, really.
Yeah, you know, this is Derek Bagley. I just wanted to jump in with that, and I think, you know, before we went on break, we were discussing, you know, voter education, making sure that we knew, you know, who's on the ballot, what they stand for, and I think that there's a valuable part of voter apathy connected to that, and I'd love to talk about that later. But I think that we also have to understand, and, you know, Will had brought this up earlier, this idea of, you know, my one vote doesn't count. It doesn't matter. You know, the system's going to perpetuate regardless of what I do. And I think that what we're really dealing with in the United States right now is a crisis of democracy, is this idea. And actually, the political philosopher Alexis de Tocqueville spoke about this. I wish I had the quote in front of me, but it was something along the lines of, if the status quo and the system that governs you shows no ability of changing, you comply to it and you say, I'm going to just stay home. I'm not going to fight it. I'm going to live my life around that system, even if it may be oppressive to what my needs are. And I think that, you know, working at Chicago Votes and working with primarily young people in the voting process and first-time voters, this is something that we're seeing a lot of, especially on college campuses, high schools, et cetera, where, you know, you approach someone to register them and they say, well, you know, my vote doesn't matter. The crooks are in office already. And that's just, you know, the way of it. Now, the issue is that this is cyclical. If we stay home, we do get crooks in office. We do get people that don't represent our interests. And then from that, you know, there are roadblocks put in the way to allow people to come out and vote easily. You know, the fact that we have to register at all, the fact that, you know, Election Day is not a national holiday where you can get off work and school to go exercise your civic right. And,
very true.
You know, it's like in this climate, you do feel helpless. You do feel, you know, what does my vote matter? But as you were saying before, you know, we are mobilized by these massive events that can really trigger, you know, people, you know, bum rushing the polls. And, you know, in the end of the day, Tocqueville in that same quote discusses that and says, you know, until there's a chink in the armor, people will stay home. But as soon as there's that one iota of weakness in that system, then they rush to exercise their rights. You see this with the fall of the Berlin Wall, uprisings in, you know, various countries with totalitarian governments, etc. And I think that that's something, especially from a youth perspective, that is very important to understand, is that we need to show the importance every time.
You know,
you see that across Northern Europe, Scandinavia, where you're getting turnout numbers in the 80%, 90%. And it's like, doesn't have to be exciting for them to go to the polls.
Indeed. Rebecca, you have a comment about that.
Yeah, I just wanted to point out that if there was ever any evidence that one's vote mattered, it is this year, earlier this week in Michigan. I mean, every single vote mattered. People turned out. People were thoughtful. People voted in ways that were completely unexpected, you know, by pollsters and pundits. And so I guess what I would say is, you know, I'm sort of old enough to remember discussing the Voting Rights Act and Mississippi Summer and all of that around the family dinner table. And I think that while it's true that many people feel that their vote doesn't matter because their lives don't change for the better and therefore why bother, it is also true, at least today, and certainly true for people who've experienced systemic discrimination and sexism, that every vote does matter. And I think you see Bernie Sanders going to the college campuses and getting these incredible responses and turnouts from millennials because they do understand their vote matters. So I guess I would take some heart from what is happening now, and maybe, you know, maybe things are changing for the better and will keep changing.
I want to say a couple of things that I think are unique about American democracy, which is, and not necessarily in a good way, but we have like the longest election campaigns in the world.
Right.
You know? I mean, this circus with the primaries has been going on since, you know, what, July, right? This is unprecedented in the Democratic world, right? There's a sense of voter fatigue when your campaign goes on for 18 months at a time. The other thing that we have that's also terrible is that we have the shortest tenure for any legislature in the entire world, right? So Congress, the entire House of Representatives, is reelected every 2 years. And that, in that sense, I think voters very rightly make this decision, like, you know, bother me every 4 years instead of every two.
Right.
To ask people to come out every 2 years is absurd. And I think that's why we have this repeated cyclical phenomenon of the midterm, you know, non-presidential elections drawing much, much lower voter turnout throughout American history.
And this past one was the worst in, what did we decide, 70 years? 72 years was the worst voter turnout in 72 years. Like, just let that sink in for a minute, that's really quite abysmal and quite shocking, although not, right, for the reasons that you've described.
It doesn't help that the Congress has, like, approval ratings of Stalin, you know, right now.
There's that, right?
Well, plus, you see municipal elections, which are even worse than midterms. I mean, I'm looking at a history of Chicago elections for the past 10 years here, and the municipals are always just the worst. And this goes to kind of that tends to protect a certain vested interest of incumbents who tend to benefit by not a lot of people coming out. And so this is starting to be debated. Like, if you really want to boost voter turnout in, say, Chicago, why don't you just stick them in presidential election years? Then that would be, you get instant, you know, 200-300% increase in turnout, so at least for those people who vote. And then, well, I mean, then you get into the argument of, well, they're low info voters. What do they know about? Well, I mean, that's not really our problem. That's not really up to us to judge. I mean, either people are voting or they're not. And so to Derek's point, you not only want to make it as easy as possible to register to vote, you want to make voting as painless as possible, which, honestly, a lot of the time it just means voting less often. I mean, just vote on everything every 4 years or some similar structure.
That'd be a long ballot. Rebecca.
Yeah, I was going to add something else to that. You know, I mean, I'm all for making registration and voting as easy as possible, but I think that if what you're suggesting is at the root, which is that the average person who doesn't decide to register or vote doesn't feel that their vote matters, then what that really argues for, and we've also seen a lot of this in Chicago in recent months, is, you know, really substantial community organizing around issues and holding elected officials and would-be elected officials accountable. And so, you know, there's something here that can be done on the substantive side as well as on the administrative side, and candidates can come to the fore if they would and say, yes, I understand this issue. Yes, I care about this issue. Yes, I will really fight on this issue. And to the extent that perhaps people who haven't historically voted push for that kind of substantive discussion and kind of candidate, others will be encouraged to go to the polls. So I'm sort of thinking, you know, that's also what we've seen now, especially in Chicago.
Right, Rebecca. And I'd also add that, well, it's not, again, this is talking to my experience as a dirt digger. I find negative attack ads for candidates. But when we talk about engagement on the debates, again, going back to my original statement about distinctions, you want to see a difference between one candidate and another. And the fact of the matter is a lot of the times that means them attacking each other. Now, this doesn't mean, like, go on and be the orange skin person we're not going to mention yet and just say anything. That means making a clear distinction that people actually care about. Say, I am different from this person. This person is bad because of this reason that I am not. And so, another thing that I notice as I go through this municipal data is in Chicago City Council elections, actually the more negative the race is, the higher turnout tends to be. It's between 3 and 5 percentage points higher if it's an extremely nasty race and the candidates don't even bother talking about their own records, they just attack each other.
That's interesting, which also speaks to that idea of this emotional draw that gets people to the polls, really. All right, my friends, we're going to take a little break. We're talking with David Ferris from Roosevelt University, Will Caskey, an opposition researcher and partner at Stanford Caskey, Derek Bagley from Chicago Votes, and Rebecca Sive, author of Every Day is Election Day, A Woman's Guide. We will be right back here in just a bit. We're talking all about voter behavior tonight here on 720 WGN.
This election, there's a lot of really important decisions being made that affect marginalized groups in big ways.
Thank you, Jesse. Which is why, as an openly straight man, I implore you to think of people like me as you cast your ballot.
This wasn't supposed to be about you.
There are 3 things that make me proud to be an American. Voting, our proud tradition of freedom and hard work, and Ryan Gosling. Even though he's Canadian, I don't care.
Why not vote? I mean, give me one good reason. You can't!
I'm voting because it makes my hand stronger for tweeting.
All the good political clips tonight because we're talking all about voter behavior here on 720 WGN on tonight's Saturday Night Special Show. I'm Amy Guth. I am joined by an esteemed panel of folks. Rebecca Sive is on the phone with us. She is the author of Every Day is Election Day, A Woman's Guide, and she is also the program director of Women in Public Leadership Program at the Harris School of Public Policy at the University of Chicago. David Ferris is here. He's the chair of political science and public administration at Roosevelt University. Will Caskey's here. He's a partner at Stanford and Caskey. He's an opposition researcher, which he'll tell us all about in a minute because it's a super interesting job I had never heard of before I met him. And Derek Bagley is here. He is from Chicago Votes. He is the development director there. He's all about helping first-time voters get the hang of things so they are very empowered voters. So we're all here. We're hanging out. We're talking about these big issues. So now I would like to talk about, because something that is recent history, but nonetheless, it is now history. I want to talk about the 2008 election because we saw a lot of new things in that election. We saw a lot of new voters coming out. We saw young people engage in a very new way. In your mind, what is the legacy of voters in that election? Because I think of it, and I kind of think about I think about, like, data. You know, I think about data was the thing that really changed that election and what made it different and what made it look different. But in your minds, what would that be?
I wanted to jump in with that one because I actually think it speaks to Rebecca's point earlier today, is that, you know, it's about organizing. It's about effective organizing. And I think that if anything, OFA, you know, Obama for America, was an effective organizing engine. It used media correctly. It educated voters. It got people out there where they were. It wasn't expecting people to be brought into the election process, you know, from the top down. It was meeting people on the streets. I mean, maybe that speaks to the president being a former community organizer, that it had that model. They call it the snowflake model, mm-hmm. And how we look at it. And I think that if anything, that's what changed how our politics is run. We need organizations to get people excited and energized about these issues through appropriate means. Because if you look at our, especially our media structures, we're fed media all day long, a lot of which is false. You know, you have memes and, false, entertainment media like The Onion that people are posting as if it were true.
And the email forwards, so many email forwards that are so wrong.
Exactly. And so it's like that to me, more than just a data level, it was a substance level. And I think that, that's extremely important going forward, is getting the right information to the people so they can make informed decisions.
Yeah, related to that, I would just add that going back to what we talked about before the break, two points. One is President Obama in his campaign, with all of the vehicles that were just mentioned by Derek, really made a case for he would be somebody different in the campaign context in a way that people hadn't heard previously, not to mention he was different, right? The second thing that I think is really important about 08, and I just really want our listeners to know this, is that women elected Barack Obama. The majority of voters were female, predominantly African-American and white. And so one of the wonderful things I would point to about that election, of which there were many, I'm a Democrat, was the fact that women coalesced across racial lines to vote for a candidate who enunciated a platform that would be beneficial to them. And that was a pretty wonderful thing, both on the coalition building side and the substantive side, and thirdly, on the turnout side.
Definitely. David Ferris, your comment about that.
I'm going to sound a slightly different note here, not to be a pessimist, but I do think from the Democratic perspective, I think that 2008 gave us a little bit of false confidence. You know, we won that election by 10 million votes, and then I think we proceeded into the next three cycles thinking, wow, we've got this magic coalition that can't be broken.
It's all good now.
Right, exactly. Yeah. And if Organizing for America was like had somehow figured out a new rule in politics, then we would have won the 2010 and 2014 elections, and in fact we didn't. So I think...
You are right. I agree.
And I wasn't sort of picking on you. I think...
All opinions are valid here on the show.
Yeah. I do think it gave sort of the Democratic coalition the sense that we can't be beaten. Mm-hmm. And I think that was proven pretty conclusively untrue in the next couple of cycles. That's not to say that all kinds of inspirational things didn't happen in 2008 and that we didn't deploy new forms of data collection and analysis, but I think that Republicans have caught up to the Democratic coalition in that respect in this cycle and certainly in the last cycle. So that to me is like, the out party is often going to come up with new ways of attacking the problem of turning out voters. And now the Democrats are the in party, right? And it's the other guys who are pioneering new tactics.
It's funny you say that, David, because starting in, I think this was early 2010, I remember I was on a campaign and there was this national study that a Democratic group had done, showing that basically it was just some stupendous number. It was like 5 or 10 million voters who had come out to vote for Barack Obama, and they were, in the word the person said, was just, they're gone. They just, we don't know where they are. They never registered. They moved on, which is to just say there was so many things happening. And I think Obama's the best president of my lifetime. I don't know if I'll ever see another one, but it's important also to understand we were coming off of a just uniquely historically despised president in George W. Bush. And you have Obama, and you had an 18-month actual presidential primary with Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama. And to Rebecca's point, women elected Obama because so many women were already engaged in the process, either for Obama or for Hillary, which we can talk about the dynamics of. But whenever we have this huge event, we always try to like put it on. We're still going to think about it as the Obama election, but it's important to stop and remember that was an enormous amount of things, many of which had nothing to do with Obama, which is not to downplay his presidency or his campaign at all. Mm-hmm. It's just that was a huge focal point. It was just this explosion of voting. But then, as we were talking about in the beginning, there's just this decay over time. And it's extremely difficult to get that back once it starts going away.
Sure.
To put on my political scientist hat just one more time here, because I really do hear what Will's saying, is that, in political science, there's this theory called critical realignment theory, that our parties every 40 years or so go through a massive overhaul surrounding by a very polarizing central issue and event that gets people out to vote. They say that we've had five of them in our history, one with Jefferson, Jackson, McKinley, Lincoln was in there too. Sorry, that was out of chronological order. And FDR, where we had exactly what Will is talking about, these massive overhauls of like a perfect storm where people are like, okay, we're reshuffling the coalition, making a new election. And I think history will remember Barack Obama's election in those similar terms, if not also Ronald Reagan's election. And, you know, that decay over time is indicative of a system that no longer fits the needs or belief systems of the people that is put in place for a very specific, you know, circumstantial reason or event. And I think that that is something that we are watching unfold in front of us at the moment.
You know, there's one other piece of this I just would add, going back to what was pointed out about what happened in 2010 in the midterms. And that is another thing that I think relates to this discussion about voter turnout and what to do about it. And that is that because congressional districts are you know, incumbents win, I think, over 90% of the time, some figure like that, in part because of the way districts are drawn, you know, that really exacerbates the notion for voters that they really don't can't expect to have much of an impact in midterms. So I would just kind of take from that while you could look at things historically, you know, from a presidential to a midterm and sort of say one was much better than the other, I don't think it's very telling. I think that what's more telling is, as was stated a moment ago, to look at these presidential, the sequence of the presidentials, and then go back and figure out how do we make the case for some kind of change that enables people to feel that their votes in congressional elections actually really matter. And I admit to being perplexed about that, but I think it's enormously important. And certainly in the Obama years, we've seen just how important the Congress is.
Certainly. All right, my friends, we're going to take a little break. We're talking with Rebecca Sive, David Ferris, Will Caskey, and Derek Bagley here tonight, talking all about voter behavior. What makes people vote or not vote the way they do, and why and when and all that good stuff. We're unpacking this whole very big issue tonight on 720 WGN.
Live from the biggest small town in America.
This is WGN Chicago, radio home of millions throughout mid-America.
Radio, well, radio became the Pied Piper to a strange new world.
WGN. Hey, it's Amy Guth, and this is the Saturday Night Special. Thank you so much for being with us. Gentle reminder before you go to bed to change those clocks. Yes, that is upon us already. Spring forward, fall back, etc. All right, my friends, tonight we're talking all about voter behavior. Who votes, why, when, all that good stuff. Apathy, empowerment, any of it, all that good stuff. And I have a wonderful, wonderful panel of experts here. Rebecca Sive is on the phone with us. She is the program director of the Women in Public Leadership program at the Harris School of Public Policy at the University of Chicago. We're also joined by David Ferris, who is the chair of political science and public administration at Roosevelt University and author of Revolution in a Digital Age. Will Caskey is here. He's an opposition researcher and partner at Stanford and Caskey. And Derek Bagley is here. He's the development director of Chicago Votes. So we have been talking a lot about some elections in the past. So now let us move to the present, because there's so much. It's a rich treasure trove, really, of things to discuss. And let us begin with events in our own city that transpired last night. As we talk about, voter apathy, it's hard to even say that word with a straight face, because clearly people were not at all apathetic last night. People were, in fact, quite engaged, perhaps a little too engaged last night, as events transpired at the Trump rally that was in Chicago. So if we take, kind of the microcosm of the Trump rally, here we have a guy who's filling a large gym and with people that were very, very engaged. He has very, very devoted followers. And then we have demonstrators outside that are very, very passionate about opposing him. And then, you know, all of this kind of transpires as these two groups meet, and the rest we have all seen play out in the news for the last day. But as we think about Trump in particular, he is a very different kind of candidate than we have seen in a very long time. And I can't help but point out that it feels like, even, you know, anecdotally, but then I would agree, too, that it seems like a very different kind of election, with a lot of extreme conversation, a lot of it coming from the Trump camp and the people around him and kind of the rhetoric around him. So let us start there with the people kind of working around not just Trump, but around GOP candidates. Let's talk about that voter. Whoever would like to begin with that one.
Well, I just want to, you know, again, this is my opposition researcher talking. So, an understated thing, we could have talked about this last segment, but an understated power in elections and in voter behavior is shame. Like, one of the lessons they took that campaigns took from 08 is that you could remind voters that they were voting less often than their neighbors, and that would boost turnout. They would just feel embarrassed and go. And I think what you see at play in this current dynamic is you see this sense of public indignity is very close to shame. Like the protests were, I saw them. I knew a bunch of people who were, I'm sure Derek did too. I mean, everyone knows some protests. And the thing they kept coming back to was, he's coming to UIC. That is our place. You can't do that. It was just this indignity, the sense of public violation. And then you see the same thing coming from the Trump supporters, because once he couldn't come in, they were just shocked. And that's when it started getting angry and a little uncomfortable to watch. Because you had the protesters who are just really happy, like they've had their public space validated. You know, he's not gonna defile it or whatever. And the other people, like, well, their spectacle has been taken away from them, and that's exactly the removal of shame is kind of what Trump's selling his supporters. Like, we're gonna make America great again. Like, you can engage in this, and America is going to be like you. You can come back out in public. Like, I'm gonna say what you're thinking. So it's this really fascinating, it's like shame on steroids. Like, everyone's being drawn into this, and I think it's going to be really interesting to see how, you know, what effect that has on.
Would you agree that this election feels different?
Oh, yeah, it's definitely. You have the ideological wing of the Republican Party just basically breaking up with this basic ad hoc alliance of, you know, people who have various grievances, and that hasn't happened for... God, I don't know. It hasn't happened since any of us were alive. I mean, the most recent precedent is Goldwater, and that was decades ago.
And we have some audio from a Goldwater campaign that we'll play here in a little bit.
I think,
David.
I think, you know, Republican elites have to be looking at last night in just abject terror, right, of what's coming at them in Cleveland. Mm-hmm. You know, because the last thing that the party wants is for their nominating convention to turn into like a three-ring circus of protests and violence and counter-protests, and that's to say nothing of the possibility of a contested convention. So last night, I mean, as a Chicagoan, last night was like incredibly inspirational, I think, in the sense in which we stood up to this, you know, toxic racist bully. But in another sense, I mean, this election is really different. You know, it's been a long time since you saw the central coalition of a political party sort of shatter before our very eyes, you know. And that's, I think, you know, I think it's because the Republican elites have not been offering their core voters very much substance in terms of, like, you know, what do we do for you exactly? And so the Trump wing of the Republican Party is in rebellion because they look at Republican policies, this sort of like boilerplate Heritage Foundation, you know, slash taxes and export job stuff. They look at this and they're like, I don't actually see, you know, what's in this for me? And the failure of Republican elites to speak to those voters. I'm leaving aside the racism for a second,
mm-hmm,
right? But like,
sure.
let's just talk about economics. And I think that's really where they've fallen short, and where the party itself has had just a colossal failure of its own elites in setting its agenda.
Indeed. Rebecca.
Yeah, I would look to something bigger, and I think more troubling and profound and important, at least in my mind, which is that, you know, two things. One is that the data seem to show from the various primaries and caucuses so far and other polling and so on, that many of the Trump voters are people who are disaffected. They're predominantly white. They're predominantly male. And they feel like the, so to speak, American dream, you know, if it ever was for them, is not now. And Donald Trump is saying, with some magic wand, I'm going to make America great again. And because there's nothing else to hold on to, that's what they're holding on to. The second thing that's really profound here, at least to me, is the racial divide. Mm-hmm. And so so blacks, while they were up until Michigan predominantly voting for Hillary, now more in the younger age groups are voting for Bernie Sanders, but they're not voting on the Republican side. Now, that hasn't been historically the case, but they, too, have largely been left out of this sort of Gilded Age economy. So it seems to me that what we're seeing right now is, yes, something very important about what's going on in political parties, something very important about women and Jews for the first time leading candidates for the presidency. This has never happened in American history. But also the fact that this very troublesome economy is mobilizing people and separating people in ways we haven't seen, I guess I would say, perhaps since the Huey Long era. So, you know, I just really think that what we need to do is, you know, confront that and figure out, those of us of goodwill, what we can do. And in the meanwhile, if that strengthens parties, so be it. But what really needs to happen is to strengthen people's lives and security.
Indeed. Derek, your comment on that.
Yeah, no, actually, I think that that plays nicely into something I wanted to share here, is that, you know, at present, I think what we're looking about it, especially in mobilizing these Trump supporters and what is, you know, getting them going, is what you were talking about, you know, just a little bit earlier, Rebecca, this idea of feeling, you know, fear of outsiders, of being isolated, of being unsafe. And I think that what we're getting is that, you know, disaffected coalition that, you know, Nixon famously called the silent majority, you know, mobilizing these voters, you know, as you said, widely male, white, you know, blue collar workers, specifically from the middle of the country, that feel that the changing norms and demographic shifts in our country and attitudes are, you know, threatening, you know, their sense of security. And there was a great study that came out of Amherst, and there's a cadre of, you know, political scientists across the country that believe in this trend. It was started by Matthew McWilliams, a PhD student over there, that said that in times when the former governing coalition, the people that used to make up the status quo, the white males of our country at this point, feel, you know, ebbed in and as if they're losing their power, they look for a strongman candidate. They look for not necessarily a tyrant, but someone who preaches law and order, closed borders. You know, we're going to make this great again, as Will said earlier. And that's something that we're looking into. And it's these studies surrounding not the authoritarianism of the dictator themselves, but of the mindset of the voter. And if we're talking about voter psychology, I think this is specifically pertinent to now, since that spirit has been radically activated across the GOP primary coalition.
Indeed. All right, my friends, we're talking with David Ferris, Will Caskey, Derek Bagley, and Rebecca Sive all about the psychology of voting, who votes, why, when they don't vote and why, all that stuff. We're talking all about it tonight here on 720 WGN, and we'll be back in just a bit.
I thought about just not voting in this election, just staying home, but you can't do that, because that's saying you don't care who wins, and I do care. I think my party made a bad mistake in San Francisco, and I'm going to have to vote against that mistake on the 3rd of November.
Vote for President Johnson on November 3rd. The stakes are too high for you to stay home.
720 WGN. I'm Amy Guth, and this is the Saturday Night Special. We're talking all about voter behavior tonight. That was a very interesting clip that was making the rounds on courts.com, dug up from the archives. I recommend you go find it and check it out. It was kind of against Goldwater. Very, very interesting. So tonight we have an esteemed panel here. Rebecca Sive is on the phone. David Ferris, Will Caskey, and Derek Bagley are here in studio with me. I'm going to turn on everybody's microphone so we can all chat and all be friends around this wonderful issue. Okay, so we just were talking all about kind of the narratives around the voters and the narratives around the GOP candidates, at least the top couple anyway. The one that's in a lot of conversations is certainly in this city anyway. But let's switch a little bit, because we are all opinions are welcome on this show. So let's switch. We've covered GOP. Let's switch to the Dems a bit. You know, what's interesting to me about the two, you know, as we talk about Bernie and Hillary, two big things come up right away in my mind, and that is, it seems like Bernie is certainly trying to, at least his campaign is certainly trying to speak to that youth narrative that Obama really tapped in 08 to really get young people excited, because he's even kind of named his own revolution. He's not even really saying candidacy or campaign. He's saying revolution. Now, then we have another narrative that I think is worth discussing, and that is around Hillary, who, of course, she's not going to come out and make it about being female, and yet that thus precludes her from naming her revolution, really. You know, so there's a bit of an inherent tension with her. But I keep running into a lot of women who are very conflicted about Hillary, because on one hand, they feel like I owe my vote to a woman. On the other hand, they indeed want to vote their conscience, and it may or may not be aligned with her. So I think there's two kind of interesting pieces that I want to get into as we think about Bernie and Hillary. But Rebecca, why don't you start us off talking about these two candidates and kind of the narratives around them?
First of all, I want to say that it's a remarkable and wonderful moment in American history when the two primary candidates in the Democratic Party are people we would never have dreamed even 10 years ago could be the candidates. I think that it's worth sort of pausing, taking a deep breath, and realize we're talking about a woman on the one hand, a Jew on the other, and in both cases, albeit with some meaningful differences in views, progressive candidates. So that's sort of point one, and I hope no one ever forgets that, regardless of who they vote for. In terms of the narrative, I mean, I think we all know that millennial women have been breaking for Bernie. Older women have been breaking for Hillary. And, you know, I wrote a little bit about this. I've talked to my students and other people, and I think one of the really interesting things about it that's really kind of paradoxical is that younger women tend to feel that we're going to have a woman someday. It doesn't have to be now. Whereas for older women who experience levels of structural discrimination that are gone, that notion of sort of waiting for someday is just not anything we want to do. We've fought hard for a very long time to be where we are. The other thing that I think is significant and a positive is that people are willing to look past sort of in that, whether they're looking at Hillary or Bernie, they're willing to look past gender and look at very fundamental substantive differences. And I do think that's a positive.
Certainly.
The only other point I would make in terms of the narrative, and I think it's really important to bear this in mind too, is that having a woman president will be transformational in a way that having another male president will not.
Indeed. Will, what would your comment on that be?
So this is just really fascinating, the concept of gender and how much feminism plays into voting for Hillary per se. And I think that one of this, another issue that we're not kind, that no one ever wants to talk about simply because a primary is happening right now, And my friends who support both candidates are going to kill me for saying this, but from the perspective of your average primary voter, there really isn't that much of a difference between the two candidates. Now, and I know every consultant friend of mine is going to text me and scream at me now, but you know, I know that they're very different candidates. Like everyone in here, like has obsessively followed the primary, and we know Bernie does this thing and he says this thing, but on the issues, on 99% of the issues, they say the exact same thing. They want to do the exact same thing. I mean, they're arguing about whether you know universal healthcare, I mean single payer. I mean that puts me to sleep, and I and it's my job to not go to sleep on these things. The only thing they really differ on is trade, and that kind of came out when you saw in Michigan. But I think this kind of, and this goes back to like when there's a lack of distinction, you know, people start to lose interest, and you can see it, like the Republican primaries had massively higher turnout, like two or three times the people mm-hmm. are voting in the Republican primary than the Democrat. And I think a reason is that is people are basically, and this isn't necessarily bad, I think this is, people are basically okay. Democrats as a party are like, well, either you're fine, And there's this basic comfort with both of them. And I, you know, it's heated. The primary is like winding down. So if you're a supporter, you think, no, you're really different. This other person's really bad, or and mine's really good. But the fact of the matter is, when you're a normal person, which is what we all try to struggle to pretend to be when we're making these decisions on campaigns, it's really kind of a wash on virtually everything that real people actually care about. So, I think that might be playing a lot into younger women who are just they just can't see the difference between them when it comes down to the actual issues on women's health, on gay rights, on all that.
If that were true, I don't think you would see the lopsided voting pattern. 80% of millennial women are going for Bernie, 20% for Hillary.
Yeah, to be sure. I'm not saying that I'm saying this in favor of Bernie, of it being a perfectly acceptable feminist choice to vote for Bernie, because he, on the issues themselves, he's just as legitimate as Hillary is. And so you see this comfort to vote. The lines of like, well, is she going to be the first one? And like you said, Rebecca, will be, well, that's kind of not an issue right now. I don't really want to think about that because there's this ideological and issue based comfort with Bernie.
Indeed. All right, my friends, we are talking all about voter narratives and voter behavior and the way we're thinking and talking about all the candidates. So we're unpacking many, many complex issues tonight, but I hope you'll stick around because we're going to take a little bit of a break. But when we come back, my esteemed panel and I are going to keep this conversation going about how we're talking about the different candidates, how voters are behaving, how voters have behaved, and how voters will behave in the future. All of that and more on 720 WGN.
Send this to 5 friends.
You sent it to 5 friends last time?
Send it to 5 more.
5 more friends.
Then send it to 5 people you don't like.
Send it to 5 enemies.
Send it to 5 animals.
Everybody's got 5 friends.
I have 7 friends.
This is way too important.
One day out of the year.
Don't let anyone get in your way.
Don't let anything stop you from voting.
Nothing. Nothing.
November 4th!
No matter how bad the weather is.
Get psyched.
Get out there. Come on.
Gather your friends.
Vote.
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 What are you doing? You're just sitting there.
Vote.
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 Vote. Vote.
Please, please vote.
It's that simple. Vote.
720 WGN. It's Amy Guth, and this is the Saturday Night Special. I'm sure you just recognize many celebrity voices in that get yourself out there and vote thing we were just listening to. We're collecting lots of clips because tonight we're talking all about voter behavior. As we get deeper and deeper into this election year, we are looking more and more at what compels us to act. Why do we act the way we do? Why do certain people feel very compelled to be very politically engaged, while some people are like, meh, and have a great deal of voter apathy? So we're looking at all those issues. I have an esteemed panel of experts here with me. Rebecca Sive is here. David Ferris is here. Will Caskey is here. Derek Bagley is here. All kinds of experts. We're all here talking about these very big issues. So before the break, we were talking about the Democratic candidates, because earlier in the show, we were talking about the GOP candidates, and there's room for everyone to discuss here on this show. So let me turn on everyone's microphone and bring Rebecca back up on the phone so we can continue this conversation. So, David, I'd like to start with you on this. As we think about Bernie and Hillary and kind of the voter narratives around them, And as Rebecca and Will were saying, how the age divide is very notable and interesting around Bernie and Hillary. What would you add to that?
Well, I'd say I think a lot of what's going on with the Sanders insurgency here is cyclical. You know, we're at the tail end of a long, successful Democratic administration. And I think that the Sanders campaign is the vehicle for the wing of the Democratic Party that is dissatisfied with the sort of the level of progressive gains that were made during the Obama administration. You know, so this is a group of people, I think, that were dissatisfied, say, with Obama's banking policies or the hiring of Tim Geithner. You know, you can make a long laundry list. So Sanders is that vehicle for people who refuse to accept the sort of the institutional limits on what can be achieved in American politics based on Republican control of Congress. They refuse to accept these limits, right? And they think that Obama should have pushed harder. And they see in Bernie Sanders somebody who won't accept the sort of Hillary Clinton theory of change, which is about incrementalism, which is about sort of recognition of the sort of overwhelming power that the opponents have right now. And I think that in particular, young people don't, you know, the 18-year-olds, they don't remember 2008. They don't remember 2010. This is all new to them. And so when you juxtapose two people, one of them is like, well, you know, the Republicans are in power, so there's not really so much we can do. Like, let's just, you know, let's just move the ball forward like 1 yard, right? And you've got this other guy out there who's like, well, forget that, right? I'm going to bring this revolution in. And you just don't look at the Republicans right now. Just trust me. We're going to bring real change to this country that we were not able to do during the Obama administration. So the candidates have talked about this, right? They've talked about these theories of change. But I think it's a really important thing to keep in mind is that this happened in 2002, right? This happened at the end of the Clinton administration, where you had Bill Bradley, who was the Sanders figure in the 2000 campaign. Right. The difference, of course, is that Bill Bradley has the charisma of like a potato, and Bernie Sanders is like is a very compelling figure. You know, I mean, regardless of whether you support him or not, I mean, he's a great speaker. He's really fired up young people in this country to demand, I think, change that the status quo elites refuse to listen to or to understand even where their concerns are coming from. And I think that's why he's had more success than Bill Bradley, I would say. You know, I still think he's doomed, but I think he has really brought a new energy into American politics that I think is fantastic. I would just say, if you're voting for Bernie Sanders, please remember to vote in 2018, too, because that's really important if right. we do have a Sanders president.
Indeed.
Amy, I have a question for
you. Yes, David.
For your panel. I'm just curious, and it's something that one of your guests just said. Is part of the problem with voter engagement that we don't have a collective or a long-term memory of where we have been?
Valid question.
I really agree with that, actually, from a youth perspective.
Well, not just from young people, but it seems that many of us who are over the age of 40 or 50, perhaps, act as if everything candidates say is something brand new, where if you're paying attention, you'll know it's not new at all, and a lot of it is just a rehash of the same old silly nonsense and stupidity.
You know, it may be that that's true, but I think that I do think that, as has been said, there are really pretty profound differences in both the substance of policy and in the process for changing policy as between Clinton and Sanders. So, and people seem to get that. They're listening. The people who are responding to Bernie Sanders are believing the notion, although there's no proof that it can happen, that there can be a revolution. We can just sort of say, oh, okay, you know, let's have single payer. You know, when we, if he were president, he would be facing probably a majority Republican Congress. So that's not going to happen, much legislative change, as Barack Obama has seen. So, yeah, there's a lot of same old, but I think actually given the remarkable difference in the profile of voters for Sanders and Clinton, that what they are saying is that they see the political world differently, the policy world differently. They want it to behave differently. And you can argue about the merits of the position, but these voters are being very thoughtful.
Well, I mean, voters are thoughtful, and this is a – I always have to find myself telling other people in campaigns, like, you can't ever assume voters are idiots. But on the other hand, the concept of memory is very tricky. A story I like to tell that's situationally pertinent here is this. The former alderman of this current physical area, Bert Nateris, I actually beat him. I helped beat him in 2007. And the biggest attack that we ran against him was voting for the Harold Washington property tax hike. And I was new to politics at the time, and I didn't understand how completely insane that was if you were in Chicago. Like, you would dare attack Harold Washington. Except it just worked. Like, people just didn't understand at all. There was no backlash at all. Not even, like, the Tribune who praised him at the time. Of course, it was in 1987, but not even that. They like, came out and said anything. And he lost by, like, 15 points. So, I mean, people, it's not to say that people aren't thoughtful, and it's not to say that they don't have memories. It's just a matter of attention. Like, the things that are the most direct that you have to remember. I mean, your brain is just another organ when it comes down to it, and you remember the things that you have to deal with on a day-to-day basis. And when it comes down to, well, what did this politician say? You know, how much is Bernie saying that Howard Dean said in 2004? I mean, I voted for Howard Dean, so quite a lot.
and then that's also buttressed by our own, filters and biases that we build our lives around. And, so I think it's a bit of that, but a bit also of just our own personal filter. Yeah. David, you were going to say.
Yeah, I mean, I think we sometimes overestimate what effect on voting some big event is going to have, right? Mm-hmm. Do you remember back when the government was shut down? Everybody on the Democratic side was like, well, that's it, man. We're going to take back Congress next
sure.
year.
Yeah.
And I think you just have to keep in mind these like much bigger structural issues often have a much stronger effect on how people vote. And that's, what's the economy doing? That's this ridiculous thing but it's real, the right track, wrong track, right?
Mm-hmm.
You ask people, is the United States on the right track or the wrong track? Right now it's like 25-65. Wrong track, right?
Yeah.
That's not good.
Right.
And the president's approval rating and, the GDP growth last quarter. Those structural indicators are actually much better predictors of how people are going to vote in a national
sure.
election.
Even if the politicians don't do anything really inherently about them to begin with.
Exactly.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, and I wonder, too, I mean, I can't help but wonder that perhaps as we see outrage over things, right, over a government shutdown or something like that, so much of it is anecdotal. And I wonder if the cycle of outrage is shortened or maybe spiked quicker and dropped quicker as a result of social media, because we see things that get really blown up really fast. You'll see it's a trending thing and it's suddenly huge. And then 3 days later, what? Who? No, we're on to Dancing with the Stars. We're on to something else. So let's talk about that when we come back. We are talking with Rebecca Sive, with David Ferris, Will Caskey, and Derek Bagley, all about the voter behavior as we're looking into this election year before us here on 720 WGN.
I'm Darren, and I'm turning out for education.
I'm EJ, and I'm turning out for marriage equality.
My name is Lil Lena, and I'm turning out for reproductive rights. Turn out for
what? My name is Ayoana, and I'm turning out for human rights.
Hi, I'm Natasha, and I'm turning out for prison reform.
Turn out for what? 720 WGN. Hey, it's Amy Guth here on the Saturday Night Special. We are already at our very last segment as we're watching the clock count down before we turn things over to the next show, my friends, which you would definitely want to stick around for, indeed. But this show, we are talking all about voter behavior, engagement, apathy, all of it. And I want to turn now to social media and media in general, because we've seen an awful lot of debates this time around, more than ever, and they are very star-studded affairs. And certainly social media is playing more and more of a role in how we talk about politics with each other and with our candidates. So I want to turn that topic over to my esteemed panel. I'm here with Rebecca Sive, David Ferris, Will Caskey, and Derek Bagley as we talk all about these issues. David, let's start with you as we talk about the digital landscape. And that, to me, in my mind, that encompasses a lot of things, because I think on one hand, it's media literacy. I keep talking about the email forwards because they drive me crazy. We all get them. They're in Comic Sans in five different colors, and they, espouse some kind of dire plea. Usually quite a bit of misinformation is in them. But then we have, certainly a lot of information and misinformation being shared on social media at higher velocity than ever. And then we have these debates, more debates than ever, and that are being televised. So where are you kind of falling on just the media landscape of this particular election right now?
Well, I think, we can think of social media as a couple of things. One is an engagement and mobilization tool. So it gives sort of the campaigns unprecedented power to connect with their supporters, to mine the data of their supporters. Whenever you download an app for one of these campaigns, it's like you're handing over the keys to your house. But also to be able to mobilize them on an ad hoc basis in a way that is really unprecedented. Like, you couldn't do this 20 years ago. And so you can see this in what happened last night, right? You had this huge event, this counter protest that was put together almost seeming like at a moment's notice. And so that's fascinating from a mobilization perspective, and I think the scholarship bears this out, that sort of when you see spikes in tweets and Facebook posts, you are actually more likely to see certain numbers of people turn out at rallies and protests and things like that. The other thing is, I don't know about you, but my sort of social media feeds are overwhelmingly pro-Bernie Sanders, and I think it's important to keep in mind that a lot of these technologies do skew young. You know, young people are early adopters of them; they're heavier users of them, and so there's a sense to which we can lose sight of the real sort of position of the race just by looking at social media. I think you have to take a broader look at, you know, what the delegate counts are and where people are in the campaign. But I'll stop there and turn it over to some other folks.
Derek, how about you?
Yeah, you know, I'm glad that you brought that up, especially as, like, you know, an indicator and misinformation and how this works in social media. And I think, you know, we were just talking about the Bernie Sanders and Hillary Clinton race before the break. I think that that's a really interesting, you know, situation with this, because, you know, I call it the hipsterization of politics, where you have all of these young people saying, yeah, man, right on, revolution, we're all involved. But then you ask if they voted, and they're like, no, dude,
right.
I don't do that. And it's like, okay, so that's ironic then, I guess, what you're saying. But, you know, it's like in the end of the day, it doesn't matter how much it's mobilizing people to go to rallies, to protest, to these things, if it's not translating into votes. And that's sort of interesting, especially when you look at something like the Nevada caucus. You know, young people overwhelmingly do support Bernie Sanders, but it's because they didn't come out and vote that Hillary won that caucus. And that's just sort of a, you know, an interesting thing to think about, especially when we're looking at how this information, you know, is getting out there. Now, that said, is that one thing that I, you know, often advocate for, and something that we've been working on at Chicago Votes, is like, how do we utilize that, you know, tag of, you know, the cool, hip, you know, meme that you're seeing on Facebook or on Twitter, and actually provide worthwhile information? Because there is no governing structure that's like, okay, I'm going to connect to people where they're at, you know, with information they'll respond to, and then, you know, turn it into votes. And so something we've been doing is creating music videos and informative, like, funny animations and things like that that actually include links to, this is how you register to vote. This is what you need to do. This is your polling place. Please, you know, also donate to our organization, so that we can, you know, have the funds to do that sort of thing. And so it's a question of turning that passion into reality. And if people aren't registered to vote or don't know that they even have to be, then that's not going to happen. And we need to provide that information, you know, in a wider scale.
Indeed. Rebecca, your comment on that.
Well, I'm a big fan of social media. I think that, you know, one of the things that I find attractive about it is, you know, everyone has a printing press, and so to speak. And so people can share their views with others. Others can consider those views. And I think that's pretty powerful. And I do think it converts into organizing and to education on issues. I watched over the last week, for instance, on Facebook, while the UIC rally was organized, and at the same time I got material from the school because I'm a graduate of a program there. So I kind of think that it's a good thing that our views aren't only having to be funneled through the media institutions, but we each have our own voice. So I'm all for that, and I'm also all for using it, as was said a moment ago, to mobilize people to vote and to act. But on balance, I think it's a good thing.
Quick question, Rebecca, just to that point. If we all have a printing press, you know, a large number of us are not, you know, formally schooled on some of these issues, don't have the facts. What do you make of that then in the respect that, you know, we all have a forum to say whatever, you know, on earth we want, and that people are digesting it and sucking it up and saying, oh yeah, that must be true, even if it's a lie?
Well, you know what, I sort of dimly remember from like high school or something, there was a term called yellow journalism that we learned about in history classes.
Oh,
and
yeah.
Right? And I think what it meant was that the publishers of newspapers or the owners of TV stations or whatever, you know, they have opinions and they can drive what the content in their respective publications or media as well. So, and that certainly is done even today. So I think we all have a duty to look at any media we read, whether it's social media or otherwise, and and kind of say, well, does this line up with the facts or not? And we're fools if we don't, as you suggest.
Yeah, I would say, you know, with great right comes great responsibility. I think that applies to, and again, media literacy really kind of keeps me up at night because I feel like we have greater access to information than ever. And yet most people are like not, or either too overwhelmed with the information or perhaps a bit lazy to go look it up and see what it is. They'll just go, yeah, right on, retweet. Will, you look like you're squirming with something to say. Please say.
It's just we talk a lot about messages and what we're saying on social media, but I just keep going back to the central shame portion of civic engagement. It really drives a lot of how we behave. And I know that Facebook has been working on integrating their data with voter files and voter information. So I was just wondering, I mean, what if that was like you could put that in your bio, like I voted or how many elections I voted, or you could even make a plugin app like to put that into it. And of course, then you can have it like weaponized, like you didn't even vote, you know, like the hell with you and your meme.
Right. You know, and as we're sitting here, like running out of time, one thing I wanted to talk about is what do we think this time next election, what do we think these technology tools will be? Because there's certainly more than there were last time, but it seems like, you know, will we ever see a day where there's, you know, a more social media based form of voting? Will we ever see a tool that really that you can, you know, the registering to vote has a lot more social piece, like you're saying, like there, can you earn a badge? Can you gamify voting? You know, all of those things. It'll be interesting.
I mean, you do see countries experimenting with email voting, right? I mean, I think that's coming.
Right.
I think that there are really serious security considerations with that
sure,
people have not
certainly.
Really quite figured out. The thing that concerns me about social media and sort of political discourse generally is just a representative example. I don't know if you remember this thing that went around on Facebook recently where you could unfriend all of your friends who supported Donald Trump.
Sure.
Right? It's atomizing.
Absolutely. Yeah. And it shuts off discourse. You know?
Absolutely.
And I can't remember the last time I had a debate with somebody of the opposite party on my own Facebook page because we've already sorted ours. I feel like I've probably been muted by the people that disagree with me. They're like, oh my God, this Ferris guy again. Get rid of him.
I'm glad you said that. I've made a point to say that on social media a few times. Mm-hmm. Hey, look, I value a round discussion. I want to know where I'm going to draw the line is if it's disrespectful. If it assumes that because I don't agree with you that I'm less intelligent, that's where I'm going to get sideways on it. But I want that, you know, fully formed discussion. And I think we should all have that. And I think that it's really important that we keep having this conversation. So, my friends, I'm going to tweet out everybody's Twitter handle that is here on the show with me tonight. A big, big thank you to Rebecca Sive, who has joined us by phone all of this time, which is so nice of you to do to be on the phone. Thank you so much, Rebecca. Again, her book is Every Day is Election Day, A Woman's Guide. We have been joined by Derek Bagley, who's the Development Director of Chicago Votes, Will Caskey, who's an opposition researcher and partner at Stanford Caskey, and David Ferris, who's Chair of Political Science and Public Administration at Roosevelt University. My friends, we have run out of time, but let's keep this conversation going on social media tonight and all week long. All right, we're going to take a little break and get you to news here on 720 WGN.